Welcome to the DermVet Podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bourgeois, a board-certified veterinary dermatologist practicing in Portland, Oregon with animal dermatology clinics. I'm also a mom of two, just trying to find the balance like everyone else. Let's learn to ditch the itch, cytology, everything, and make derm more fun than frustrating.
I love being able to have my friends on the podcast. I'm very excited today to welcome my good friend, Dr. Gary Marshall, to the Derm Vet Podcast. He has over a quarter century experience being a feline practitioner. He practices at Island Cats Veterinary Hospital near the Seattle, Washington area, and he is currently the clinical director of student development. He's also very involved in organized veterinary medicine, currently running for AVMA vice president, and has recently received Washington State University's Distinguished Alum Award. I was so excited to have Gary on today to talk about cats, to get the side of the practitioner who just deals with cats on what's realistic on how you can manage these cats, how to medicate these cats. Of course, I can speak from a dermatologist lens, but I love to have other people on the podcast to compare notes and just to see how things may be a bit different. So I really hope you enjoy this episode of the Derm Vet Podcast. Well, welcome everyone to another episode of the Derm Vet Podcast. I am always excited to have guests on, and it's just been thrilling to have more and more people back on the podcast as I get to more interview type episodes. But today is especially exciting because I have one of my really good friends, Dr. Gary Marshall, on the podcast today. Just a dear friend, has been really supportive of my career and my family. And I'm just really excited to have a cat vet on. I know before we got on, you said, oh, I'm just a cat vet. Listen, cat, feline veterinarians, you guys are tough and a different breed. I mean, it is not easy to become so specialized in handling cats. So I am very excited to have you on the podcast today and learn from you and discuss things and hopefully teach other general practitioners how to manage these cats a bit better. So thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
I am thrilled to be here, Ashley. It's always fun to see you and especially to talk about cats.
Cats, they are their own breed for sure. Isn't that true? Their own species. Well, let's just kind of, you know, obviously don't be asking me about like fluted or anything crazy because I have no idea. But if we just talk about skin disease in cats, because I know you're still seeing a significant amount of dermatologic disease, even specializing in cats. What do you feel like the most common things you see if you thought, okay, the top 2 to 3 things I see as far as feline dermatology?
Probably the top 3 are all people with concerns about itchiness in their cats, different forms of itchiness. Either they are like really itching and bothering the owners because they're sitting there or the owners are worried about them, or that they've just got patchy hair loss or scabs or those types of things. And that probably is leading to itchiness, even though they're not as concerned about that just day in and day out.
And do you feel like there's certain patterns of itchiness you see? Because what's always tough, and I find this especially true for cats, is they can show their itch in so many different ways. So if you think about a cat coming in a typical like clinical presentation or distribution you see, what do you feel like you're not shocked to see come into your exam room?
Oh, yeah. Well, with cats, there's nothing super typical, right?
Right.
I loved your podcast a couple of weeks ago about like the whole thing revolved around it depends, because that's so true. It was great.
And we bonded on that. We bonded on that, didn't we? When you were doing cat class and you say it depends for cats too. I think that really is something simple that can hold true for most aspects of veterinary medicine.
I'm running out of it depends stickers, but even in Texas this last weekend, people were like up on the podium, we're talking about it depends, and I would walk up and give them a sticker. It was great because that's all the time. I would say though, when I have a cat come into the room, my brain is going to engage a little bit differently if it's bilateral or if it's unilateral or focalized in one area of the cat, and then we start thinking about okay, what's going on that would lead to these different patterns, even though there could be, you know, 5 different bilaterally symmetric problems and they could all look different on different cats.
And do you feel like you see a lot more like truncal disease, or like when I think about cats who come to see me, which is definitely going to be a bit different than what you would see more commonly, like I would say like bald belly cats, you know, like bald belly cats, we see a lot of kind of the rump, like back half of the body having less hair on it is something we see more commonly. Facial excoriation, scratching towards the face, is something we see fairly commonly. Do you feel like that mimics what you see in general practice, or do you feel like it's different?
No, I think I see all those. Definitely the bald belly that the owners, like that we find on a clinical exam, that's not brought in for that. And then we have to discuss that. The rump, the ears, face. I also, the ones that probably puzzle me the most is just patchy limbs. And I don't have a good, like, oh, it's patchy limbs, that means this is what it is and this is what I'm going to do, because those are all a little bit different. And so those are definitely is it bilaterally on the limbs or is it just one limb, and those types of things that make me fine tune kind of my next steps.
And I love the fact that you keep bringing up like bilateral versus like a focal area, because I've heard you mention that a couple times and it is so important. You know, what I am typically going to see in my practice is probably going to be more like a symmetrical or a bilateral distribution of these signs, because, you know, most of the time, and not always, they're referred to me because there's suspicion of allergic dermatitis of some degree. You know, for those of you who don't know, if we talk about environmental allergies in cats, it's a really annoying name. It's feline atopic skin syndrome. Just because of the different ways they manifest it, that is kind of where we have landed, which is a bit of a mouthful. But essentially, I'm usually getting referred cats to work up that, ectoparasites, things of that nature. But when we talk about certain things like just going after one limb, or just having patchy alopecia on one limb, or, you know, a focal area on the belly, there are other things besides allergies that can cause hair loss and itch in cats, right? Like a urinary tract infection, right? You probably see that. I like hardly ever see that because usually the primary is ruled it out. But is that something you see, say like a bald belly cat, and it's a certain distribution that you have seen, like a urinary tract infection or fluted or anything like that, cause those issues?
It's on the list, definitely, especially if it's, like, I think that they're just turning to one side and licking one side of their belly or one side of their flank. We also think we can't rule out bilateral, as you know, if they're arthritic and they only want to turn one way. Right. You know, they're just doing more on one side than both sides, even though both sides probably do itch just as much. And as far as like just one spot, we don't see what we think of as hot spots in cats very much. I don't. You probably do, because they come to you more than they do me. But it's something that has to be on the list of, is this cat just going at this one spot because there's something about that particular spot as opposed to a systemic type thing. And other things that I hate having on that list, and some of these cats that are really aggressive, like it looks like a hot spot, it's like a hyperesthesia thing, because those are so challenging and they're more, you know, potentially neuro or internal medicine than actually skin disease, but that's where it's affected the most.
Yeah, I have seen videos of cats with hyperesthesia syndrome, and it is awful. In fact, when I do some lecturing with Dr. Pockel, our friend who's a behaviorist, like he has some videos of that, and they have discussions between neuro, behavior, internal medicine, and those are ones where if I'm suspecting it, when they come in to see me, I'm like, ooh, like, I don't know that you're in the right place, because I don't even know really what to do with that. But I like something else you mentioned, that if you mentioned feline arthritis, and I think feline arthritis has gained a lot more attention, right, in the last like year or two because of Solensia coming out. But they can also chew and lick. I think we see this a bit more with dogs. That would probably be like my interpretation. But recognizing feline osteoarthritis a bit more now, like if they have a certain limb that's really arthritic, they could chew, lick, really bother a spot from that. I don't feel like we see that as much in cats for, you know, behavior reasons. If they're going after one spot, like on the limb, I feel like that I'd be doing x-rays or, you know, talking to their primary veterinarian to see if we need to work up that limb further rather than just assume we throw them on steroids. Would you agree with that?
Yes, but a lot of times, I mean, we can't just like take an x-ray and say this is arthritis or not, because there's such a wide range of what that x-ray might look like. And, you know, I'm kind of old school, and I kind of just made it up as I went along. So a lot of my focus on these is going to end up being response to therapy. But if it's arthritis versus itchy, you know, you put them on steroids, they're probably going to feel better in either one of those.
Both work.
So sometimes it helps you as kind of a means to an end, but it doesn't help you get closer to the answer, unless they're limping, and cats are so good at hiding anything from us. So then it comes down to education and a conversation, because those owners are going to be such a good resource. If you say, now I'm trying to figure out if this cat is itchy or if it's sore somewhere, and letting the owner know like what this might look like a little bit differently at home versus obviously in the clinic. So we can use them to help us figure out what's going on a little bit better than we can just do in the clinic.
And that is so important. I mean, cats in particular, like, history is so important in pretty much any aspect. Mm-hmm. It is so important to really take the time to ask a cat owner these questions, because cats are tricky, like you mentioned. And I obviously don't see bald belly cats as a specialist on an annual exam. Like, they're coming because that's there. But I hear many of my friends who are practitioners mention, oh, yeah, we're doing the right, like, I'll do an annual exam. Owners won't even notice that there's a bald belly, because cats are by nature groomers. And so what is over grooming is always a really difficult question to have. If there is multiple cats in the household, sometimes it's helpful because you can say, like, oh, do they groom more than your other cat? But where do you draw the line, right, to decipher what's too much grooming versus not, if you're not looking for that and knowing it can be a clinical symptom of something? That's tough.
That's so true. All the time. Every day.
Yeah. So let's focus a bit on cat allergies, because, you know, predominantly that's what we're going to see a lot of these cats for. And we're both in the Pacific Northwest, you know, you being near the Seattle area, me being in Portland. And so we're in pretty high allergenic areas. You know, we deal with things like not just pollen, but mold because of the moisture, and then ectoparasites, obviously. Do you have the same struggle? So when I think of cats and allergies, I'm like, you know, for the love of goodness, please, 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 before you refer them to me, have them on an isoxazoline, just please, because then if they're better, cool, they don't have to spend the money to see me. And if they're not better, or they're only partially better, cool, you've just taken a very easy step away that I have to start out with that owner. Do you feel like you see the same, like a lot of these cats with flea bite hypersensitivity that you can manage with flea control?
Yeah, practicing on Mercer Island, we don't let fleas come across the bridge onto Mercer Island, so we don't have to worry about it as much. But I'm just kidding.
Lucky, right? If only.
A good chunk of my patients are indoor only. They are and the clients that they live with don't have a lot of dogs with them. So I don't see day in, day out a lot of what I think is flea allergy dermatitis, but you have trained me well. And so have the other local dermatologists, that it's like, if we're going to work this thing up further, I don't think this is fleas, but we're going to use this. Otherwise I'm going to get scolded when you go to the dermatologist, because we haven't been doing this consistently. There's some, definitely, but not a ton of those cases that they get back to me and say, oh, we don't need to do anything anymore. Now that I've been, you know, using whatever, everything's fine. I just don't see that much with my particular patient base.
And it's always important to realize that locations can be different, right? Even being in the Pacific Northwest, maybe having that kind of island in that area is a bit more protected. And even when I lecture, you know, all people in like high desert climates were like, nope, we actually really don't have to worry about that. But I think you hit on something really important. Like, I try to be really real life and realistic. And I, you know, I'm not one to be like, if you have an indoor cat and they're not itchy at all, like, yeah, flea control is great, but it's more if they're symptomatic, right? Yeah. Like, of course, it's also nice in general, but if they can't because of cost or whatever, and they're a normal cat living their life and they're happy, like, I don't know if I'm losing sleep over that. But the ones that are going to get to the point where they're like, we are itchy, you know, we're uncomfortable, things aren't working, especially if you're like giving a steroid injection and they're not fully responding, or, you know, you could kind of control it like that for a bit, and now they're not really getting that length of time or duration that they once did. it is just one of those things that I always say is an easy win. Like if we can give them an easy win and we don't have to medicate their cats orally or be on medications, or it just takes that step away from me when they come to see me, that I can say, oh, you're on Revolution Plus, Credelio, Bravecto, you know, whichever. Now there's NexGard combo. Like you're on one of those. You've been consistent. And I would say the other thing is making sure everyone in the household is. Right. So the dogs and the cats. Because I have had many a cat where because they're an indoor cat, either they're not on flea prevention, the dog is, we just put the cat, they get better. But I've actually had situations where the cat was because they were itchy. So like the primary vet had said, hey, they're itchy, let's get them on flea control. Yeah. But the dog wasn't. And so then I'll say, well...
It's always before the dog's fault.
I don't blame the dog, right? But before I'm like, before we allergy test and spend thousands of dollars on all this stuff, like, let's just, again, easy win. And I have absolutely had cats where just putting the dog on flea control helps. And what's important to realize about ectoparasite control, it's not a force field, right? Like everyone's like, oh, but they still have to bite. Like it's not a force field around them where like fleas can't come within 3 feet. You're just really trying to minimize the population that that pet could be exposed to with a fast speed of kill product. And that's why it's really important to have them all on it.
Yeah.
But then when they come in to see me, I can say, okay, that's controlled. Because we do see cats with multiple allergies. And sometimes that's the hard part too. People really want, I see this with dogs and cats. Well, we put them on flea prevention. They didn't 100% get better, so we stopped. What if they're flea and environmental? Then it's like, well, if flea prevention controls, you know, 40% of it and it's not fully controlled, but that's controlled, like maybe we will be more successful with immunotherapy. Maybe atopica will work better and we don't need steroids. So that's kind of the hard thing, too, are these cats with multiple allergies.
Yeah. One point that came up to me in there that isn't necessarily those derm patients, but When I am talking about flea control with my clients, they're saying, well, I don't see any fleas. It's like, you know, cat, even if they're not itchy, cats can harbor some fleas. But also, I really think that cats are just so good at grooming that they can slurp up all the evidence. So even if you're flea combing them, everything else. So I tell owners, not being able to find anything does not mean you don't have fleas in your house. And so I use that as a statement to try to convince them to that it's important, especially, you know, with kids, others in the house, you know, that everybody needs to be treated if there's any suspicion at all. So,
yeah. What do you think about food? So let's say you have a cat that you're potentially going to do like a diet trial on. You know, cats can be exceptionally difficult with diet trials. What kind of tips or success or things do you, if you're going to have that conversation with an owner, lean on? Or are there certain diets that you really enjoy or like for these cats that you suspect a food allergy?
Yeah, that's a really good one. Because cats are picky. I guess my go-to is really decreasing variables as much as possible. So if they're on all sorts of treats and all sorts of other stuff, and they're on canned food and dry food and all this, I try to really convince them. It's like, we're going to do one thing, and maybe your cat's not going to love this the most, but if it eats it, it gains, it maintains its weight. We're not going to worry about all these other things for a period of time. And that first thing that I can usually get cats to go for and the people is getting a bag of a hydrolyzed protein dry food. I hope there's some hydrolyzed protein canned foods coming out that a cat will eat, but so far that's like a zero. Like, so I don't even try with the canned ones, even though they say my cat loves canned food, but the hydrolyzed protein dry, and maybe you can alter my recommendations, but I say if you go through a bag and your cat eats it and your cat's not better by the end of that bag, it's like, we got to look at other stuff. But if you give me that length of time and we'll commit to this one bag, then I think we can really decide where we go from there. And then I'll try to introduce some limited ingredient, single protein canned foods or other stuff to that if we get that far.
I think that's fair. And again, I think what we have to always recognize, and I'm always respectful of this, is clients who are just seeing you day to day and you guys are starting this are going to, we're going to see different types of clients, like predominantly, right? Like I have the people who are kind of like, simple things are not working. So, I love hydrolyzed personally. And so what we tend to see with cats with food allergies is a lot of facial pruritus. It doesn't have to be. I've certainly had cats who don't, but that is just what the studies show can be a little bit more common. And there's a couple hydrolyzed. So, I mean, there's ZD canned. And I don't personally use a lot of ZD just based on some of the chicken allergies we know can flare with that, but just to recognize that that is there. And then Blue HF has a canned version. I've had a lot of cats not like it, but I've had some really like it. So again, what I have learned about food, I can have my favorites, but in the end, you can't tell me one diet that works for every single cat that every single cat will eat, that every single owner is happy to feed. Like, that is just the reality with food. Food is love. People have opinions on it. So I try to be really open, but I also will be very informative of if you've gotten to me and I'm worried about a food allergy, like, we can't just say, oh, but I don't feed chicken, so they're not food allergic. Like, yes, I do use a lot of the hydrolyzed diets, but I always ask owners, like, I go 8 weeks. So it kind of depends on the size of the cat. I had a 22 pound cat in the clinic yesterday, so he probably gets through a bag of food pretty fast. But it always depends on you, right? Like, so I say 8 weeks, and then I ask them, like, are you fine with just kibble? What's your comfort level with this food? You know, can, do you have to have a canned? Well, then maybe we do just need to do novel protein right off the get-go. So those are kind of the conversations that I have with them. But it just depends on the owner and what they're willing to do. And if it's just overwhelming and they're going to like half commit to a diet trial, I just tell them to wait till they can fully commit, because I might only get one or two chances at a diet trial. And if they're like, well, but grandma's coming over and she's still always going to give this, you know, they're spending 2 weeks with us. I'm like, then we wait till 2 weeks. We wait till they're gone, because it is a diagnostic test. And I think it's really important for people to recognize that and use that wording with owners, too. Like, I tell them, like, this trial is a diagnostic test. So we want to do it correctly, because at the end of it, our goal is to hear yes or no, your cat is food allergic or not. And if it has not helped us at all, then we get to move on with confidence and realize we're not missing something. But I think that helps owners realize why it is so strict, because it's a diagnostic test. And then we can always pivot long term if we find out the cat is food allergic. And maybe they have different desires, like, of what they want to feed their cat.
Yeah, I think that's important, because I do a lot of that the same. And I tell my clients a lot of times, I'm pretty simple. There's a couple things I want to know first. And for me to know these things, sometimes it's a test, sometimes it's a trial. Sometimes it's with a drug, sometimes it's with food. But like you said, it's like, if we can't do this thing for this long now, then we're going to wait, because I'm not going to learn anything. And then it'll be just, I won't be any closer to being able to help you if we aren't able to commit to it for whatever period of time.
Perfect. Definitely. Now let's move on to that bugger that is feline atopic skin syndrome. So when we talk about these cats that you are suspecting there's an environmental allergy, what does that conversation look like as far as the treatment options? You know, and again, totally respecting that I'm going to have a different kind of clientele and conversation. And I think that would be expected, or else my primary events aren't going to love, you know, sending me cases if we're not having different conversations. So what does that look like if you kind of come to the conclusion that a cat is environmentally allergic?
That's a good one, because like we've talked about, they're all so different. And sometimes we have, like for myself, with being in practice for 25 years, and we have, you know, the grandkids of some of my original clients are now clients of mine, that we're in it for the long game. So we're able to piece together a little bit more probably than you are with some of these histories and stuff, that maybe it's seasonal, maybe it's never happened until right now. And we try to kind of figure out what may have changed to initiate that, whether it's environmental or something else, chemical or something in the home. So that will play a role in getting to that point. And then I also try to weigh what's the urgency and the panic of the client, whether, you know, it's mild, no big deal. We want to really, really learn, and we want to know exactly what's going on and how we step into that in the diagnostic process. Or it's like, I can't sleep. My cat's, you know, chewing a new hole in its leg or something like that. And then in those patients, I will jump more to what is it going to take to prove that we can stop this problem. And I will usually go to steroids on that or something like that first, as opposed to, you know, Atopica or something that is non-steroidal. And just to get that, do we get relief or not? Because I learn a lot from that. And as opposed to you, I do have a favorite injectable steroid I like to use in those particular situations. Because a lot of my clients are like, you want me to give this pill this frequently for this long? Again, it comes back to that. Can we get this done? And am I going to be certain with the answer to the question that I want? And for me, in that initial one, a little injectable triamcinolone is my favorite.
Yeah. And just to loop back to that, when you say opposed to me, so before Gary and I hopped on, or even when I first asked you, like, Dr. Marshall, please be on my podcast, you said, well, just don't like shame me about steroids in cats. I'm like, I use a ton of steroids in cats. I think we have to be realistic. There is not much on label for cats, and you can utilize steroids are a great tool. They can be a bad tool too, right? Mm-hmm. But they are a great tool. And the reason that Dr. Marshall's mentioning, like opposed to me, I don't use a lot of injectable steroids, but that does not mean I have any shame in a general practitioner doing it. The reason that I don't is because the cats who just get like one or two triamcinolone injections a year or one depo a year and they're hunky-dory the rest of the year are not the ones I am seeing. Like, I am seeing the ones that we were on depo and now it only lasts a few weeks. You know, like, we are to the point where that is not going to be the solution. And the reason we will lean more towards an oral steroid, and yes, everything you're saying about the complications of giving cats oral steroids is so true. And I will work so diligently with owners, whether it is, do we need to compound a liquid? Do we need to, you know, we don't just say give this if it's difficult, but it's because I'm usually having to use them more consistently, like a pemphigus cat or a really bad allergy cat. And so then if I can get them to the point where they're more on like every other day steroid and we're controlled, I personally see like less like diabetes or other issues. So there is no shame for me, because I think if I was in general practice and I just had to give a steroid, you know, shot, and that made their life easier, and the owner kind of knows the risk, which honestly, a lot of times cats handle them okay. We think of the terrible stories that happen, though, right? We have to make these cats comfortable. Like, we don't want to be so afraid. I see that all the time with feline otitis. I know we're going to talk briefly about that, where I always get asked, like, what can you put in the air? What can you put in the air? What can you put in the air? And we all know there ain't much. Right? That's on label for cats. But if we are so afraid to treat that ear, you know, it's also not good for that ear. Like multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas that we're not treating is also not good for that middle ear. So to your point, like, yes, we have to be like thoughtful and we're going to have different ways that we handle that. But I just want people to have the comfort to know, like, cats are difficult and we have to provide a good quality of life for that. We don't want to abuse them and not use them appropriately. But they can be wonderful tools to make these cats comfortable.
Yeah, I love steroids.
Listen, I do steroid trials sometimes too. Like, I've had some cats where I'm like, I'm pretty sure you're allergic, but like psychogenic alopecia is extremely rare. But like, I mean, so if I give you steroids and I know you got better, then it's not psychogenic alopecia. But if I'm like tried my third or fourth type of steroid on you, you're not responding, maybe I'm questioning myself a bit more. So I do think like there's an appropriate way to do that, but you also have to educate the owner, right? Like, well, I need to know if there's a response and then we'll move on from there. And then you mentioned Atopica, so let's talk a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. So with Atopica, I kind of say both. Tell me about that when you're starting cats in it. Because I believe we've had conversations where you primarily use the capsules. Is that correct?
Yeah. The liquid, even though it's labeled for cats, is just nasty. I think I have one out of a few dozen patients that would actually take the liquid just because they went to that because they couldn't get the capsule in. I really, really like the capsule. And if it, not every client can get it in, but I will see. Usually it's one that I've seen that the steroids will really benefit it. And then I'll put them on Atopica. And for a longer term, I don't want to put them on steroids forever. So let's try this instead. And I get wonderful results if they truly are an atopic cat. So I we're having a little bit more trouble getting it on some of the online ones to order it for people, because my clinic, as far as being able to inventory it now, that it's like, I don't want to spend all this money to have this stuff on my shelf. And so some of the online pharmacies, veterinary ones specifically, are like, that's not a cat drug. You can't order it for your clients. Even if we say, you know, it's okay off label, that we've just seen a trend in this in the last month or so. So I don't know if any of your listeners are going through any of that. But I don't have a workaround for that just yet. And if you're having trouble getting it, just look for another source, I guess. Look for another pharmacy.
Yeah, it's interesting. We haven't had that issue, but again, we're using probably a lot. And I use the liquid or capsules. I ask owners. I tell them the liquid is bitter, but I still have had owners that are successful with it. And the capsule's not tiny. So, you know, I kind of give them the option either way. And I just say it's a starting point. We could always move. But it is on label for cats, the liquid version. And it really can be a great tool for these cats as long as they tolerate it and it's effective. The dosing being 5 to 10 mg/kg, which a lot of cats like the labeled kind of syringe dosing on the liquids is 7 mg/kg dosing. So you can kind of vary from that. One trick I have had with some of the liquid, if they won't take the capsule, and it was gone for a while, but it's slowly come back, is it's off label. Hardly anything's not in cats. But Cyclovance, which is a non-flavored liquid that Virbac has, it's on label for dogs with allergic dermatitis. If I use Apoquel in cats, that like I tell them just off label, but we've had some fair success with it. So it's non-flavored and some cats will take it really well. But you just have to let them know that it's off label but we, knock on wood, haven't seen a lot of indications beyond just like normal cyclosporin side effects like vomiting and things of that nature. And then, go ahead.
I was going to say one thing, and maybe you have some advice on this, is if I am starting them on Atopica and it's the capsules, pretty much any cat, I'll start on 25 milligram. And if it works great, then I'll just say, let's try the 10 milligram. Because you really only have, you know, you can't break it in half. You can't change the dose. So you're either going one or the other. So I'll usually go with a 2-week or 4-week supply of the higher dose and see how they're working and then see if we can get away with the lower dose. And sometimes we can't. We go back up to the 25.
Yeah, I dose it out. So it usually is a 10 or 25 unless you have a huge cat, just based on the limitations with the capsules. I've occasionally had cats who are fairly big where we almost have to do both. They need like 35 milligrams. But I think in general, you're going to get a large population of cats with that. Yeah. And then what are your feelings on allergy testing in cats? Is it something you recommend? Is it something you've seen success with? Do you do it on yourself or do you refer them out for that?
I don't deal with it. And I will, I tell them there are some options that I haven't had cases that have been really helpful to the options that we can still do after that. And if they're really into like, I want to find this out, I want to do the, you know, hyposensitization or whatever, we'll refer them. We have dermatologists here that will do that. And I don't exactly know what they're doing. I just get a report back that says they're allergic to this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, that's fine. I'll help you with whatever you want us to do after that. And that's not something that I've tried to fill my brain with how that all works. And because it changes too. And each one's a little bit different in how they do it. And so it's like, I trust them and we'll just go with whatever they decide. But that's very few, a couple cats a year, I think.
And I think that's realistic. You know, I think if it's something that you're not confident in how to do it, I think it's a really easy thing sometimes for people to say, well, we'll just do an allergy test. But I actually if you're not comfortable with immunotherapy or describing that to your owners, like I'd prefer owner, you know, just to say, well, this is not hitting your goals or your cat's not responding, then we should refer you. Because dermatology is something that can be easy, right? We're not like doing a crazy surgery, most of us. So like it's pretty easy to do it within your practice. But I always encourage, like, if you're going to do immunotherapy, either really know how to do it or refer out for it. And we have to be careful because allergy testing, it's so easy for people to get caught in the weeds with that and say, but this, and they want to tear up their yards. And, you know, it's not a test we do diagnostically. It's one to guide our immunotherapy. So, but I will tell you, I have had cats who do extremely well with immunotherapy. And when we are limited on what we have available for cats, or they don't want to take oral medications, the owners that are willing to do it, it's not that it's 100% successful, but it often can allow me to lower the dose of Atopica or just use it seasonally. Or I've absolutely had cats that fully respond. So if you are in a situation where they can't medicate or it's not working, I love referring, because those are the cats that we might have the ability to help in a different way.
And I'll tell you, Ashley, probably a lot of that is not just that I don't want to invest the bandwidth in it to figure it out and to manage those issues. It's more that I want somebody else to have those conversations with these clients, because it's a lot. And that's kind of in the last few years, we finally said, not doing international health certificates anymore. It's like, we can do them. Maybe we're supposed to do them, but it's just a pain in the neck. And there's other people that's their business. So we're going to refer them to that because they take up too much time and we're plenty busy anyway. And if there's somebody else that's all they do and that's what they focus on, they're going to be better for those clients and vice versa.
I think that is great. I mean, I think we have to protect our bandwidth to some point. Like I said, like, I would much rather you say, hey, there is a possibility to do like allergy shots. We're going to send you to someone who wants to do them. Like, I honestly think I hear all the time, like, I didn't even know you existed as a veterinary dermatologist. Like, I think the people who are going to start to really actually consider that, they are going to probably, I mean, I get asked questions by clients where I'm like, oh, I don't really know the answer to that. Like, I may have to investigate for you. So I think that's great. You want to talk about bandwidth, anything that's not skin and ears, I'm like, we're going to have to ask your primary vet, because my dog has a primary vet, because I don't know what to do. You know, I can't give her a dental. I can't, like, the primary vet we see in Portland, she's always like, oh, well, you know, we could just, you know, I could help you get the vaccine started. I'm like, no, I need you to listen to her. I need you to palpate her. Like, I need some, like, I got her allergies. Don't worry about that. But like, beyond that, like, I am helpless. Like, to have to know everything you guys do is mind boggling to me. So I love that if you're just like, you know, there's these options, but I'm not the right person for that. I mean, that's how we work collaboratively, right? Like, that's why I do all this specialized training, to know how to handle those patients for you. But also, like, you are the pet's advocate as a general practitioner to be able to say, there's other options, but that I'm not the one to do it. Like, you should go see someone who has really learned how to do it, so we can give you the best chance to respond. Yeah. And then the last thing I do want to ask you about, this has been so wonderful, I know we could chat forever. Let's talk about ears and cats kind of as our closer, because I do think that's difficult and we get asked a lot about, and I've had Dr. Diesel, a dermatologist in Texas A&M a few years ago, we talked about catotitis on the podcast, but it is really tough. Like, what do you feel like the most common things, if you see a cat with an ear infection that you're using, or are you flushing cat ears? I know that's always scary for people. What do you see in your practice?
I don't love this topic, because they're typically...
No one loves this topic, Gary. Oh, no one loves this topic.
And it's, and then it's even when you find out, what the heck are you going to do about it? Because the ears are uncomfortable and you got to put stuff in the ears. Maybe you don't. Maybe there's other ways. But cats hate it. People hate doing it. They're usually not, nobody is usually able to do it well enough at home to manage the problems completely topically, I feel. And so it's frustrating, and they come back again. And so this is one where I will sort of claim that, and usually we're seeing mixed things, right? We're seeing yeast and we're seeing bacteria, and there's probably an allergic component, all that kind of stuff. And the products that I have on my shelf are, they're going to have antibiotics in it. They're going to have antifungals, and they're going to have a steroid, as opposed to just a one item, just an antibiotic or just an antifungal that I'm putting in ears, because I want them to be soothed a little bit too. And maybe I just don't have enough experience by doing it just by myself with all the different plethora of products out there. And if possible, I try to manage as much as I can systemically. So I've found, if I see bacteria in there and it smells like bacteria, it's just a nasty ear infection, I think I get so much better benefit by a proper oral antibiotic than I do with topical stuff in those ears. A lot of times you have to do both, but so those are the ones I like to be able to make a big benefit on, are the ones that are stinky, gross, nasty, lots of bacteria. It's going to have other stuff too, but, if we get a culture, we can put it on an antibiotic, and I see those feel better, so much better. And a lot of times, even, you know, once they get rid of the infection, a lot of times the yeast takes care of itself, I think, on some of those, if we're cleaning them occasionally. But maybe you'll tell me I'm doing it all wrong. I need another focus on this. But it's that's kind of where I go to.
It's just always different. I'm never here to tell anyone they're doing something wrong, because again, we are seeing different clientels and different reasons, right? I would say to briefly end on feline otitis. For me. So I do successfully get a lot of owners to do topical therapy. Again, I am probably seeing a different form of clientele, and I will always respect that. Don't get me wrong. I have cats that, that's not the case, but I'd say in general, the ones who come to see us, like it's an option. We know Trezoderm is historically the one that's labeled in the U.S. In other countries, Sirulan is labeled for cats. But then you really don't have a ton of options. In general, most of us find things like Baytrol pretty safe. So you'll see a lot of people compound different formulations, and you can talk to compounding pharmacies about like Baytrol dexaline, Baytrol dexconify. Of course, you could use Baytrol otic, but there's no steroid in it, which to your point, a lot of times can help with comfort. But I've had wicked nasty ear infections that we have to reach for, you know, other things like Mometamax, Positex, and that can be scary. But again, a really nasty like Pseudomonas is also scary for the middle ear. My biggest thing I would kind of end on talking about feline otitis is, please find out why it's there. I would say more often than not, I actually see feline otitis from an ear mass. They can get it with their allergies, for sure. I've seen it. We see it with food allergy, things like that. But they don't tend to break out with otitis as much as dogs. Dogs, like, you know, allergies, it's like ear infections all day long. Again, not that it can't happen, but often as we clear out that debris and we look again, all of a sudden there's a mass hanging out there, or we'll send them for CT. So especially if you're having a unilateral otitis or an otitis situation where one ear keeps being significantly worse and the other ear just got a little bit of infection, just keep in mind that we do see that on cats, because then if they go to VO or surgery, they often can do really well. Whenever we treat an ear infection, we just want to know why it's there. But yeah, cats are limiting. So if you have one you absolutely cannot touch and you culture and you feel like you get good systemic options, like, I'm definitely not here to say that's wrong, because there are cases where that can happen. I've had dogs where they can't touch their ear and we have to reach for things like systemics, even though we'd prefer not to. So I think that's just real life medicine, you know, that we have to help these pets. You know, we can try to give them tools of how to do things, but in the end, if they just cannot do it and they can't bring them into you every day to put eardrops in for them, like, I just am not one to say, well, we got zero options for you then. It can be frustrating, but we still have to help them make their pet feel better the best we can.
And I love me a good polyp. Those are so satisfying.
Oh, man. Ending on a funny note. So I have this poor owner who keeps trying to get in to see me. I just yesterday had a second cancellation for, it's like an 8-month-old cat that has a polyp. And it's the second cancellation of can't catch cat, like, for the appointment. And so they're starting to ask, like, our staff, like, what do we do? And the staff's like, well, we haven't seen them, so, like, you need to talk to your primary vet. But, you know, like, here's some, don't try to catch them right when it's time for the appointment, you know, or, like, get them desensitized to the carrier. So it's interesting because it's always, like, mostly young cats. And then it's always, like, a bit of a squirrely situation.
Yeah. Ah, cats.
I know. Right. And that we could end right there. Oh, cats. It depends. Well, with that, Dr. Marshall, I just want to thank you so much for being on the podcast. Just really good insight. I think it's always nice to have people who, you know, cats are difficult, but I love having general practitioners on too, because I think it's great for our practitioners out there listening to the podcast or technicians, you know, just to see that there are some differences, but ways that we can really help these cats, whether it's referral or just learning or kind of using someone with a lot of experience like yourself. So thank you so much for being on the Derm Vet podcast.
It's been an honor. It's always great to talk with you. I hope that some of it was a little helpful.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Marshall, for being on the podcast today. It was so awesome just to be able to see different insight from a feline practitioner, some things we may do similarly and differently. I think what it really comes down to is we have to make sure with the limited options we do have with cats that we ask owners, involve them, what can they do, what their expectations are, and don't give up. And it's okay to use steroids in cats. I think that's the other thing. Of course, we have to be aware of their side effects, but these cats also deserve to have treatment. So I hope you enjoyed listening just to our discussion, our conversation. As always, please rate the podcast if it's something that you love, that you find enjoyable, and that you learn from, so I can keep getting really good dermatology education out to you.